for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Earlier this month, the school board in Rhode Island voted to fire all the teachers at one of its high schools. Educational scholar and historian Diane Ravitch thinks that was a bad idea. As a one-time advocate for No Child Left Behind, the former assistant education secretary might have once supported such a decision. But now in a new book, she explains why she's reversed her position and why she believes testing and school choice are undermining education in America. The book is titled The Death and Life of the Great American School System. Diane Ravitch joins me in the studio. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Diane Ravitch, so good to see you.
It's great to be back, Diane.
I must say, every day we're hearing about layoffs. We're hearing about teachers being fired. We're hearing about schools closing down. You have had a change of heart about school systems and what needs to be done. What's prompted that?
Well, what prompted it was that whereas I was initially a supporter of No Child Left Behind because I was hopeful that it would improve performance, I began looking at what was happening. I mean, I constantly was watching what was happening. We didn't begin to see the results of this until 4 years or 5 years into this reform. And I was at a conference in 2006 here in D.C. at the American Enterprise Institute and heard a dozen scholars get up and say, the remedies are not working, the sanctions are not working, children are not choosing, children don't want to leave their neighborhood school. Then the next year, 2007, the scores came out from the national test. Whereas all the states were reporting dramatic improvement in achievement, the national test came out and said, there are no gains. In fact, the gains were larger before No Child Left Behind than since No Child Left Behind. So I found myself disaffected and beginning to have a very different view of almost everything that's going on in that's called school reform. I wrote the book because I realized that we're into an era today where accountability means punishment. And the politicians, particularly here in D.C. and also in the state capitals, say someone has to be held accountable. Let's close the schools. Let's fire the teachers. Let's lay people off. And I began to get the feeling, particularly with the growth of the choice movement, these two things are actually connected. We are closing public schools and replacing them with privately managed schools, which is privatization. And my great fear is we're destroying American public education, and that's something that I would not want to be a part of, and so I felt it important to say that right up front.
But weren't you a part of it?
Well, actually, I was not a part of No Child Left Behind. I was there when it was announced, but there's some sort of myth that's been perpetrated that I was one of the architects. I was not an architect. I think this would be very surprising to Margaret Spellings and Sandy Kress and the others who actually did design it to hear that I was in the room. I wasn't one of the designers. I was a supporter of testing and accountability. I was a supporter of school choice. But I think I've learned. And if you're not willing to learn, then you're just an ideologue. I think that these are destructive movements that are ultimately not going to improve student performance, not give us the educated citizens that we all want, and ultimately be very, very harmful to public education, which is not good for our democracy.
It would seem that privatization, that school choice was heading toward taking schools out of the public realm, putting them into private hands. Is that the basis of the wrongful direction for
Well,
schools?
It isn't just that privatization itself is harmful, although I'm beginning to think, I do think it is harmful, because we begin to lose the public sphere. We begin to lose the sense that there's a public responsibility for public education, and to have this kind of naive belief that the private sector knows more always than the public sector, and all we have to do is to look to the collapse of the financial markets in 2008 and say, to ourselves, do we really want to have a market-based school system where schools are constantly opening and closing as shoe stores and Walmarts and other stores open and close depending on the market? I don't think that that's a correct understanding of what schools are and should be. I believe that schools are and should be the anchor of their community. It's a place where people, parents and members of the community can get together around the common concerns that they have around children. The more we split up kids and send them all over cities and say, you're going to go to this teeny high school, that tiny high school, there is no community. And it's actually very harmful to our democracy, I think. But there's a more important point, which is, as I researched the effects of school choice, of charter schools and vouchers, I found that they weren't making a difference anyway. They're on the whole, charter schools do no better than the regular public schools. And so the whole argument for charter schools is the public schools are failing, we'll replace them with privately managed schools. But in fact, study after study shows they're no better.
Dr. Ravitch, the last word I would apply to you is naive. So the question becomes, how did you get taken up with this belief that maybe public schools were failing and the only way to fix them was with this idea of charter schools, vouchers, privatization?
Well, you know, if I'm naive, I certainly shared my naivete with, say, 90% of the Democrats and Republicans in the Congress. When No Child Left Behind was passed, it had overwhelming support. And the leadership of you know, Senator Kennedy and the Senate, Congressman George Miller and the House, very smart men, very smart staffs, they too. And in fact, Congressman Miller today is still one of the most ardent supporters of No Child Left Behind. And I was at a discussion yesterday at the American Enterprise Institute, and there were people on the panel challenging me and saying No Child Left Behind has been a great success. There was a member of the Clinton administration, his inner circle, saying you're wrong, the test scores are up. And you know, we had a debate about the data. I think my book pretty well puts that to rest. No Child Behind has not produced big improvements. I mean, when people defend it, they say, well, if you start with the year 2000, there have been improvements. Yes, but 2000 preceded the passage of No Child Left Behind. So when you really look at the national test scores, which are the only ones that I think have any validity at this point, because the state scores have been so corrupted by cheating and by institutionalized fraud, it on the national level, the gains preceding No Child Left Behind were bigger than the gains following No Child Left Behind.
Describe institutionalized fraud.
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. One was in the state of Illinois. And when Secretary Duncan was appointed by President Obama, President Obama got up and talked about the dramatic test score gains in Chicago. But just a year ago, or less than a year ago, a group in Illinois, the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago, produced a report saying that most of those test score gains were just a result of the rescoring of the test by a new testing company. That when they looked at the actual results, there were very small gains. And then in the high schools, there were no gains at all. And the Secretary Duncan pioneered this kind of business model of closing schools, opening new schools. He had a plan called Renaissance 2010. And hey, it's 2010. Chicago schools have not experienced a renaissance. And the studies done by the different evaluation groups in Chicago have shown that improvement has been a very, very meager at best. So if Chicago is the national model, then we're all in trouble. New York State would be another example, where a new test were introduced in 2006, dramatic increases between 06 and 09. But it turns out that they were the result of having lowered the passing mark, so that today, on the 2009 test in New York State, a score of 44 is considered proficient, 44%. Now, most of us would consider if you got a 44% on your math test that you failed. But in New York State in 2009, that was considered evidence of proficiency. Now, that's what I would call institutionalized fraud.
What about the new standards imposed by the governors of states yesterday? Is that a step in the right direction?
Well, I do think it's a step in the right direction. At this point, the standards they haven't been imposed, they haven't been implemented. And with any kind of standards, the real test is the implementation. And we won't know, I would say, for probably 3 to 5 years whether these standards are successful. But I think it's a very hopeful sign that there is an effort to create good standards. And now that they're out there, which they hadn't been until they were released the other day, we'll begin to hear people saying, I don't like this, I don't like that. And, they'll review them, presumably make them better. But the proof of the pudding is going to be when states begin using them. And then if we see improvements, great. But there's kind of a strange media response that says, aha, we have standards, everything's going to be better tomorrow. Not going to happen. It'll take years.
Dr. Ravitch, money is a huge issue. Schools around the country are closing in part because there's not enough money to support them in districts where there aren't many students. Money is at the root of many teachers being fired, many schools having to close. What do you say about the money going to public schools?
You know, we're right now still suffering across the country from the effects of the recession that started with the collapse of the markets in 2008. And the states are in terrible shape. They all have, I don't know if every single one of them, but most of the states have tremendous budget deficits and are having a hard time paying their bills. It seems to me that, the stimulus that was passed by the Congress set aside $100 billion for education, and $95 billion was to help the schools and the states survive the worst effects of the recession. That money is going to be running out very soon. I would think that what the Congress and what the Federal Department of Education should be doing is to help the schools weather the worst of the recession. We really have to stop this whole era that we're in right now of closing schools, closing public schools, and turning them over to private hands. This is what's happened, for instance, in Kansas City, where half the public schools just got closed the other day.
Diane Ravitch, she is research professor of education at New York University. Her new book is titled The Death and Life of the Great American School System. Welcome back. Diane Ravitch is with me. She is a spokesperson on education. She is professor of education at New York University. We're talking about her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, and its subtitle, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. We'll open the phone shortly. I'll look forward to hearing from you. Let's talk about what No Child Left Behind has actually done, in your view, to the American school system.
What has happened as a result of No Child Left Behind is that, first of all, schools were given a totally utopian and unrealistic target. They were told that 100% of children must be proficient by the year 2014. Everyone knew at the time they passed this that this was not going to happen, but the law had specific penalties that if you don't get closer and closer to that goal of 100% proficiency for every student, black, Hispanic, low income, special education, various disaggregated groups, your school would be eventually privatized or closed, or the staff would be fired. We are now beginning to see this happen, where schools are being closed, turned over to private management, turned into charter schools. This is what I call in the book a timetable for the destruction of American public education. Furthermore, what it has done because of these onerous sanctions has caused teachers in grades K through 8, or 1 through 8, 3 through 8 especially, which is where the law applies, grades 3 through 8, to focus on testing in reading and math. Now, the more you put the emphasis on testing and reading and math, which certainly are very important skills, the less time there is to teach the arts, science, history, literature, geography, civics, and there are schools that have even eliminated recess and physical education because the children need more test prep. So what we're finding, what I've found, and I think most people have, is that the state scores are going up because, first of all, the states are engaging in this, what I call the fraudulent lowering of their standards. So we're dumbing down the standards. And at the same time, children are getting higher scores because they're being taught to take tests. So they reach high school and they have test-taking skills, but they don't know anything. Mm. They don't have the background, the knowledge, the general knowledge. And furthermore, because No Child Left Behind says you have to get your graduation rate up, the graduation rates are going up, and then children go to, young people go to community college, they can't pass the remediation test. So they get into remedial classes in community college, and then they soon drop out because they don't have any of the knowledge
can't
or skills to make it there. So we really have been engaged in an 8-year process of dumbing down kids, lowering standards, and it's just, and also threatening the very survival of American public education.
What kind of job do you think the D.C. schools are doing under the leadership of Michelle Rhee?
Well, I haven't looked closely at D.C. schools. I have to say, I just watch her from afar. I was very concerned that she came in with a kind of an attitude of attacking the teachers. And what I've seen nationally is that any leader who wants to attack the teachers first is making a huge mistake. If you can't get the support and cooperation of the people who are working in the classrooms, it's very hard to succeed. You can't come in by saying the teachers are lousy, let's get rid of them. It creates a very bad atmosphere. I hope that she's learned from her experience that she's got to work with the people who actually are engage with children every day. That's the key role as the teachers.
But isn't this whole race to the top coming from the top, coming from President Obama, coming from Arne Duncan as head of the Department of Education?
Well, absolutely. I am very critical of the race to the top because the very concept of a race to the top is, to me, at odds with equal educational opportunity. We're not seeking to have a race to the top. We're seeking to have lift up all kids, which No Child Left Behind failed to do. But the race to the top has specific ingredients that I think are very harmful. First of all, it says to states, you have to build a data system so that you can evaluate teachers based on the test scores of their students. What that will do, that provision, is to make sure that teachers teach to the test even more than they are now, focus more and more on the basic skills, and take all the worst elements of No Child Left Behind and make them even more onerous. Because once you say to teachers, your salary, your tenure, your lifetime
job,
all
of that depends.
Everything depends on your student test scores. And student test scores are shaped by many things, not just by the teacher. They're shaped by the family and whether it's supportive, whether the student makes an effort, whether the student comes to school every day, by the popular culture, which is so deeply anti-educational, by a million and one things, and not just the teacher. Of course, the teacher has an impact, but to fire the teacher because the student didn't make an effort is ridiculous. You're putting the life of teachers in the hands of their, in many cases, their students. The other thing about race to the top is that it says to the states, remove all limits on privatization of public schools. What President Obama and Secretary Duncan have done is to adopt No Child Left Behind, and they plan to give it a new name. And this is why Secretary Duncan last fall was barnstorming the country with Newt Gingrich and Al Sharpton. The message they were sending, and this was at President Obama's direction, was this is a bipartisan program. We're building on No Child Left Behind. And since I think that No Child Left Behind was fundamentally flawed, I think that the race to the top is a pernicious approach to education reform.
And, of course, the stress on those young people who are taking test after test because they have to prove that they know something, that must be very difficult as well.
I think that, I've had, since I began talking about the book, an amazing thing has happened. First of all, it's out of print everywhere. It's into a third printing, and it's only been out for a week. Amazon's out of the books. I mean, it's amazing. But I've been getting like 200 emails a day from teachers and parents saying thank you or why didn't you say this sooner? And I'm saying it as often and as loud as I can. I started writing against No Child Left Behind 3 years ago on the op-ed page of the New York Times. But I think the biggest stress, aside from the for kids, they don't even know that there's a better education that they ought to be getting. The biggest stress is for teachers, because teachers are being told if anyone fails in your class or if your class is not making big test score gains, you're the one, you're the culprit, your job is at risk, your livelihood is gone. I've been getting emails from teachers in that Central Falls, Rhode Island district. This is a district in Rhode Island that has one high school, and they're firing the entire staff of the high school. Was the art teacher responsible? You know, if you look at the school, everything I know about it is they are dealing with the poorest community in the state of Rhode Island. They have many children who turn over, constantly moving in and out, children of migrant laborers. Many of the children don't speak English. And from everything I've learned about that school, from hearing from teachers there and in nearby communities, there's a very good staff. They're doing the best job they can, and they're all fired.
And in what? In Los Angeles, you've got massive layoffs at middle schools. What are these kids supposed to do?
Well, they'll put them in a charter school and some privately managed school. And those schools, on the whole, won't be any better. I mean, it's what we're doing today is floundering. And the approaches we're taking are to beat up on teachers, close public schools. And I just don't know where we'll be 4 to 8 years from now if we continue on this path.
Is the push to close public schools and to enhance charter schools and other types of schools, is that basically a money issue? Is it basically just to save the public money?
Well, it doesn't save money, because when charter schools get started, they'll say that we cost less. But the next thing they say is, but now we want as much as the regular public schools. And they go to the legislatures and demand to have equality of funding, which seems only right. You know, they're educating kids just as much as the public schools are. The problem is that there's this myth that's gotten out there that charter schools are always better. And the myth is fed by the fact that there are some excellent charter schools. But there are some terrible charter schools. And if you look at the whole, for instance, if you look at the national test, which has compared charter schools to regular schools since 2003, there have been national tests in 03, 05, 07, 09. Charter schools have never outperformed regular public schools, not for black students, not for Hispanic students, not for low-income students, not for inner city and not for urban students. And so this myth that they will somehow magically lift performance is simply not true.
Here's an email from Leanne in Washington. She says, has there not been overwhelming evidence for decades that schools in low-income neighborhoods do worse than schools in wealthy neighborhoods? Why, then, are we still funding schools based on property taxes?
Well, that's a good question. She's right that there is overwhelming evidence that the single most reliable predictor of academic achievement is wealth, and poor students are likelier to perform worse than students from affluent homes. But the reason we have public education is to level the playing field. And this is one of my big concerns about the Department of Education. Rather than going out and using its billions to, say, privatize the schools, focus more on tests, and to impose all of these dubious strategies, it really should be doing what we wanted it to do since 1965, which is fund the districts where the poorest kids are so that classes can be smaller, so that teachers can have the resources they need, and so that the students in the poorest communities can once again use public education as an escape route from poverty.
What would your idea of a good national curriculum look like?
Well, you know, when I served in the first Bush administration, the thing that I was most interested in was promoting national and state standards. And at that time, my idea of national and state standards was in the arts and science, history, literature, geography, civics, even physical education. But it was a well-rounded education. There's a great quote from John Dewey, which I always think of, and that is that what the best and wisest parent wants for his child is what we should want for the children of the community. Now, people who live in affluent communities do not limit their children to the basics. They do not say, you're going to take tests in reading and math, and you're going to spend 3 months out of the year preparing to take the state test. They would be incensed if that was imposed on their children. So what we should want for all children is that kind of rich, broad education, of course, with the basics, but the basics are the beginning. They're not, should not be the end.
Who drafted the standards you're talking about?
Well, what we did at that time was to give grants to the major professional organizations and to bring together everyone, starting with the National Geographic Society, and they would bring together all the people interested in geography, and did the same thing in the arts with, it's made me think, reflecting on where we are today, that I would like to see only one federal mandate, and that would be every child should have the opportunity to play a musical instrument. I think that would be a wonderful starting point. Instead of just focusing on reading and math, what about the arts? The arts, for many children, that's the reason they come to school. It's the opportunity to sing in the chorus or to play in the band.
Absolutely, yep. And if you take all that away, what fun is there at school?
Well, I've had many emails from educators saying we've turned schools into places of drudgery where all the kids are doing is learning the rubric and all of this very technical stuff about if you get this kind of a question, you eliminate this question and these two bubbles and you're left to choose between those two bubbles.
So, in effect, you've got a lot of business or market-based reformers taking charge of schools.
Well, what's happened has been that we're increasingly seeing the removal of democracy from education in this country, and it's part of the undermining of public education, where in some cases, Secretary Duncan approves of this. The idea is that the mayor should take charge of the school system. He should have no school board or a powerless school board, and then the mayor will do whatever he wants with the expectation that the mayor will then open lots of charter schools, hand them over to private entrepreneurs, and just keep, as long as the analysis is that the problem with public education is that it's public. And so if you can get the public out, you can improve the schools by fiat, and it's just wrong. I mean, there are lots of problems, but that's not it.
Diane Ravitch, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And we'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Oklahoma City and to Kelly. You're on the air. Kelly, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go right ahead, please.
I'm a mother with a high school student. My daughter's 15 years old. I chose to leave a good-paying job 9 years ago because we wanted a higher quality of life for our family. What I have noticed, and I feel like my daughter and her classmates are the guinea pig generation for No Child Left Behind because she's been in school exactly, during these years. My observation is that the increasing choice, and there are many more choices for school, but always for those who have the most money. And what I feel like has happened is that the socioeconomic makeup of public schools has changed in the years my daughter has been in school because the people who have the most means can opt out. And that's just the observation I have to make.
Well, I think you're right, Kelly. I was visiting recently with my relatives in Phoenix, and they have high school and just starting college kids. And I asked them about where they went to school, and they said, they told me there was a charter school down the street. And I said, well, what kind of kids go to the charter school? They said, oh, the rich kids. We went to the local public school. But I think for me, that's not actually typical of charters. What charters typically do is to go into the inner city where they then skim off the most able students. They get the kids who apply and the families who are motivated to apply. And then what happens is they do not have their fair share of the children who don't speak English. They don't have their fair share of the kids with disabilities. And when they do have kids with disabilities, they're the children with the mildest disabilities. So then the public schools in the same neighborhood have an extraordinary proportion of kids who are hardest to educate. This has been found in study after study, although the charter people will deny it. It's true.
Have you talked with Arnie Duncan yourself?
Well, I did meet with Arnie Duncan last fall. We had a very nice conversation. I think he's one of the, you know, kind of most open and warmest people I've met. I really enjoyed it. But we fundamentally didn't agree because he does believe this market strategy worked in Chicago, and I just haven't seen any evidence that it has.
But how can two people who are so well informed about education come to such widely differing conclusions when the numbers presumably are there?
Well, you know, I think Arnie Duncan, he's had his own life experiences, and I've had mine, but he's fundamentally, I would say, listening to the people connected to the Gates Foundation. And the Gates Foundation has enormous power, and something I write about in my book. I have a chapter towards the end called The Billionaire Boys Club about the Walton Foundation, the Gates Foundation, and the Broad Foundation. The Gates Foundation is now today worth, I don't know, $30 to $50 billion. They have more discretionary money than the U.S. Department of Education ever had. And he listens to them, I think.
Diane Ravitch, the book we're talking about, The Death and Life of the Great American School System. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Amy Ryan. On The Wire, she played a cop. In The Office, she played an HR person and Michael's girlfriend. She co-stars in the new movie Green Zone as a reporter who is fed misinformation about WMD in Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Your calls and questions for Diane Ravitch, her new book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System. Now to Elkhart, Indiana. Good morning, Ron. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I will come to the point right away. I was a school board member for 15 years in Elkhart in a consolidated school system, which was supposed to be, the end-all solution for public education. I'm old enough. I had three kids that went through high school while I was on the school board, and I'm old enough to remember that bashing of public schools and public education started with the launch of the first Sputnik by Russia, And it's been going on ever since. Public education has been taking a hit. I've always maintained, while I was on the board and since, that, you know, we have the premier secondary education system of the world, and most of those kids come from public education at the high school level. The last thing I wanted to say is that Edward Deming, one of my favorite quality improvement experts, said, always had a famous quote that said, for every complicated problem, there's one simple solution, and it is always wrong. And he was right. Complicated problems have complicated solutions. And these quick fixes that I have seen go through the public school system all the time that I was on the school board never worked.
Dr. Ravitch.
Well, I absolutely agree, and I noticed, for instance, that there's a lot of emphasis on let's make schools more like businesses. Businesses compete. Businesses pay performance pay and merit pay, and businesses have, you know, it's a fight to the death, a struggle to the survival of the fittest. But schools are not like that. They shouldn't be like that. We don't want schools to compete and try to put the other one out of business. In fact, we see more of that now in the charter sector, where in New York City, where I live, there are charters taking public school space, pushing out the public schools and saying, you know, to the public education sector, we're going to eat your lunch and put you out of business. But that's wrong. Schools should be collaborative. Schools should be places where teachers share what they've learned with each other. Schools should be able to share what they've learned. And if they have a better way of doing things, they should tell everyone else about it, as they do in medicine. This is a professional approach, which is to try to engage in common effort towards a goal. And I think that's in line with what Edward Deming wrote and said.
What about salaries for these commercial schools?
You mean the charter schools?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the way the charter schools operate is that they function on having lots and lots of young people coming in, working 50, 60-hour weeks, sometimes 70-hour weeks. Many of them are single because it's hard to have a family and work that kind of schedule. So they pay competitive salaries at the bottom of the scale. What is I think, going to be the undoing of the charter sector is the outrageous salaries that some of the charter operators are paying themselves. And I'm not talking now about school principals, but the rainmakers, the people who make the deals with the politicians and go out and are the public face. Some of them are paying themselves $400,000 a year, $500,000 a year.
Wow.
Out of public funds. Or maybe they have philanthropists who pay their salaries. We had one charter school in New York City where the woman who was running it got a golden parachute of a gift of $700,000 from the charter sponsors. I mean, this is something that in the public sector people would find shocking.
What about Teach for America? How well do you think that's working?
Well, I think Teach for America is a very fine program, and I'm not critical of it. I think it's wonderful, but I think it is not an answer to the problems we have in American education. I know that they bring in about 10,000 young people a year who work very hard and sometimes get better results, sometimes get the same results. But to think that a profession of 4 million people is going to be changed by the infusion of 10,000 a year or 20,000 a year who leave after 2 years or 3 years, this is just ridiculous. Let me say, and this is, I think, essential that we should all remember this, education in America needs to be more professional, not less professional. We need superintendents who actually know education. We should stop with this charade of bringing in lawyers and businessmen and generals and admirals to run our school systems who know absolutely nothing about education. We need principals who've been teachers, who can help teachers, be able to go into a classroom and say, this is a good teacher, this teacher needs help, because they themselves were master teachers. Instead, we're bringing in principals who got a training program for a year and then became principal, and themselves were never master teachers. And now we're turning to teachers who have had a 5 or 6 weeks training program and discarding the experienced teachers who should be able there to help the newcomers. So we're in the process of not only privatizing our schools, but deprofessionalizing what should be an honored and esteemed profession.
I was fortunate enough to grow up here in Washington, to walk to a elementary school, to walk to a junior high school, and walk to a high school. Is neighborhood part of the problem, that these kids are going all over the place instead of being part of their community?
Well, see, because there is this commitment on the part of so many of our national and state leaders and the kind of people who are driving education policy, they have a commitment to the idea of a market. And in a market, you just shop wherever the best bargains are. You get your shoes here or there. It doesn't make any difference. So they are actively, in some places, in some cities, closing neighborhood schools and replacing them with schools where kids have to apply to get in. And there are, in some places, where kids would have to enter a lottery to get into the school across the street and have no public school to go to.
You're saying that if I were in that situation today, I couldn't automatically go to that neighborhood public school.
There's a strong bias against the zone public school, this idea being, well, they shouldn't have a right to have the kids there. They have to compete with the charters. So everyone's competing for the kids. And you know what's sad about this, and I describe this in the book, is the charter schools started in 1988 with the idea that they would become R&D laboratories to help public schools. Instead, they have been taken over by private entrepreneurs with the idea that this is a great money stream. You can go to the bank with this commitment of the government funds. And then in many places, they're trying to put public schools out of business instead of helping them.
So the bottom line is, do you believe public schools are on the way out?
I think we're at a very critical moment in American history, and I'm a historian of American education. I was asked on some TV show the other day, why do we have public education? And I said, you know, if we go back to where we were in the early 19th century, some kids would be in religious school, some people would be privately tutored, some people would go to these little, what we would call charter schools now, but a lot of kids would have no school at all because that's what the market does. The market has winners and losers. And when we started public education, it was with the idea that educating our children is a public communal responsibility. We are now in the process of backing away from that responsibility. And I think that what I'm trying to do with this book is to awaken the public and say, let us protect public education. Let's preserve charter schools, but make them schools that actually solve problems and help public schools rather than compete with them in a dog-eat-dog contest. And I would like to see a revival and a renaissance in public education so that the promise that was there for you, Diane Rehm, and for me, Diane Ravitch, when both of us went to school many years ago, so that other young people today would be able to find a good public school in their neighborhood where people realize they're part of a community and responsible for all the children.
To Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Ronald.
Thank you. Dr. Ravitch, I just finished reading your book, and much of your thesis I will agree with, but there are some finer, more discrete points that must be more clearly defined. And in the context of Kansas City, which is a national educational disgrace, and compared with the charter schools to, quote, simply close a school, then educate kids, I think we need to focus on two things if we really want. One, education is a distributed economic system, and there are those who want to reserve the best for their children, and we need to discard the notion about family background with respect to the distribution of quality education. As Dr. King said in his book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, the purpose of school, particularly public school he's referring to, is to teach so well that family background is not an issue. I think if we really want to make No Child Left Behind working, I think you'll agree that transparency, disaggregation is the greatest part of the act, but you need to speak to the waivers and the that states got in the gaming of the system, the playing close effect. And I close by asking you to comment on this. If the standard is, in terms of closing schools or opting for charters, one, is the proposed transition they're taking in Kansas City, for example, educationally sound? Secondly, is it fiscally prudent to meet the demographic academic needs of the student body served? I think if you answer, if any community answered those two questions fundamentally on all of this, we'd end up with better education. I would ask you to please comment on that.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you. I agree with your comment that the disaggregation of scores showing what the achievement gaps are and what kinds of well, if you want to call it progress, is being made, that that's been a useful aspect of No Child Left Behind. If I were to make one single recommendation to the Congress and the Secretary, I would say that in reauthorizing the education law, they should remove all the sanctions because the sanctions have been very harmful. And the reason so many schools are closing is because the federal law requires them to close. And instead of supporting and helping the schools to get better, we're closing them down. So as far as Kansas City goes, I don't know enough about the specifics other than that they're closing almost half their public schools. My sense is that they're doing this because of under-enrollment, and it's when you don't have kids, you have to close some schools. But I think that part of the problem here is that No Child Left Behind, as it now exists, has been such a distraction and such a misdirection of resources, and it's caused so many people to be alienated, both teachers and students alike, that we've saddled the schools with a burden that they should not have. And the best way to improve the whole situation is to get rid of the federal sanctions, which are not based either on research or on evidence, and would make the law better immediately.
And now to West Bloomfield, Michigan. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning. I was a teacher for 16 years, and I have two children currently in high school. As we are no longer property tax-based in Michigan, we're now state-funded. And as our economy has gone downhill, we no longer have money to fund our schools. My son has one more year in school. They've had to take out classes, and I don't know how he's going to be educated. When you close schools, when you put the sanctions on that you're speaking of, then where do the kids go? What kind of education do they get? I definitely think that you're on the right track. I don't hear anything said about teachers teaching the test. This is the first time I've heard that, so that they won't get fired, because they are required to show that their children perform. And that's become just like this perfect tsunami in Michigan, where you have to teach to the test to make sure your kids perform, but we've got no money, so our teachers are being laid off.
All right.
Well, I think you're right. And, you know, everything that I wrote in the book supports the direction that you're going in, which is that we are taking steps through federal policy, and especially federal policy, that's actually undermining our schools.
So would you be in favor of removing that property tax element and putting the responsibility on state taxes overall?
Well, you know, we see different results in different states. In some states, I know that the removal of the property tax has caused some communities to say, well, since we can't help our schools, we're not going to pay a higher tax. So it's caused that kind of resistance. On the other hand, the property tax causes tremendous inequalities because some districts are poor and don't have the money. And I think what the states try to do and should continue to do is use state funding to equalize, just as the federal government should use federal funding to equalize.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And that really is the key question, isn't it? How you use national policy to bridge the gap between the wealthy and the poor.
Well, that's an important thing, but more important, I think, is your vision of what a good education is. And if you know, if you have some concept of a good education as one that crosses, you know, history, science, literature, geography, all those things, then you have to be discontented with No Child Left Behind. And if you start with your vision of saying, this is what good education is, this is what we want for all the children, then you, at least at that point, you use the funding for the right reasons and not just to pump in more money to the testing companies and the test prep companies.
And are the test prep companies making tons of money?
Well, we've created a big industry. It's now a multi-billion-dollar industry, preparing kids to take state tests.
So if you were Secretary of Education right now, what would the first thing you would do be?
Well, the first thing I would do would be to continually assert what good education is and explain about, you know, what we want. We want the best for all children, and this is what we mean by the best. The second thing I would do is go to Congress and say, repeal all the sanctions and federal law because they haven't worked. We're not improving performance. We're focusing too much on testing that dumbs kids down. And the third thing I do is get rid of this ridiculous 2014 deadline. And even if you call it 2024, we're creating utopian goals. It's a little bit like saying America will be crime-free by the year 2020, and if it's not, we're going to close down all the police houses and fire all the cops. That's where we are.
That's quite an analogy, and you believe that to be the case.
I think that what's so dangerous about No Child Left Behind is that 2014 deadline that's forcing everybody to either push the scores up fraudulently. We just had another testing scandal yesterday in Chicago. Get those scores up or face firing. And, you know, we're seeing the firing. We're seeing the closing of schools. We're going to see more and more until this law has changed.
What was the testing scandal in Chicago?
Well, there were some schools where the grades had been erased and changed. and this happened in Georgia a week or two ago. I suspect, you know, for me, this is penny ante stuff. The real big stuff is when the states themselves and the state bureaucrats change the scoring of the system so that parents are told 90% of the kids are proficient, and then the federal test comes out and it's only 29%. Now, that to me is institutionalized fraud.
Well, Dr. Ravitch, your book title is The Death and Life of the Great American School System. How optimistic are you?
Well, the crusader part of me says I want all the people who are concerned about public education to get active in their organizations.
To rise up,
to get we have two big teacher organizations. It's usually called the Blob, but the Blob right now has been totally supine because they don't want to criticize a president that they worked very hard to elect, which I understand, but they really have to get involved to save public education. Whatever parent organization people are in, whatever teacher organization, whatever civic organization, they should be agitated on behalf of saving and improving. I mean, I'm not saying things are good. I'm not a status quo person. We need to improve education by quantum leaps, not by these little things that we're doing now that are so harmful. The pessimistic part of me is that all the powerful people and at the leadership level have a different view.
Diane Ravitch, her book, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, is titled The Death and Life of the Great American School System. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner.